The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
In a world reclaimed from burning skies, man's best hope, John Rourke, sore and bloodied, watches a 500-year-old space shuttle return to his barren planet. But do the seeds of the new world include the spawn of evil?
We shall destroy him, destroy her, destroy them all. And then Krakowski shall return to what used to be Germany and France and Italy. He shall destroy the wild tribes. And I shall be master of this earth. Or there will be no more earth.
We can make a beginning here. Or we can make the same old mistakes all over again. It's gonna be that way again, unless we stamp it out. Stamp out tyranny right now.
We must sacrifice all to stop these traitors to the new Reich! These traitors to honor! These traitors to purity! These traitors to strength!
John Rourke clashes with old world evil as his new world desperately clings to life in Survivalist number 12. The Rebellion.
Smoke Jensen has come a long way trailing Stratton, Potter, and Richards, the bandit trio responsible for his family's brutal murder. Traveling under the alias of Buck West, he's finally found them in Barry, a town that takes up a piece of Idaho territory that's still raw, untamed frontier. Now Smoke is about to make sure that the town of Barry lives up to its name.
I'm Josh Richards. You don't much care for Deputy Rogers, do you, Mr. West?
I don't think he's got both hands in the stirrups, that's for sure.
But he does what he's told to do.
That's important to you, Mr. Richards.
Very.
You know, if the money's right, I can be as loyal as any man. More than most, I reckon.
I imagine you can. Are you looking for a job, Mr. West?
When do I start?
Oh, I know why you're here, Mr. Kirby Jensen, a.k.a. Smoke, a.k.a. Buck West. You're here to avenge your wife, your son, your father, your friend Preacher. You're so full of hate it's consuming you, eating you alive. If you let it, boy, it'll destroy you.
Potter! Stratton! Richards! This is Smoke Jensen! I'm giving you a better chance than you gave my pa, my brother, and my wife and son! 24 hours! You ready to die?
I wish I'd never heard the name, Jensen.
You'll never hear it again after today, Richards.
William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man 2. Return of the Mountain Man.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Elias Madero, you surrender your ship and we'll let the crew off in your lifeboats.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Taking your ship, sir. In the name of Sacred Liberty and the New Tex Militia.
Graphic Audio presents The Serrano Legacy by Elizabeth Moon.
So the ship blew? Or was blown?
No, not enough debris. Let's see if we can find any bodies.
Their tongues have been cut out, and they're naked. I can't tell out here if it was done before or after death.
Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Elizabeth Demery, Sonny Lasky, Peter Stray, Jeff Baker, Thomas Penny, James Konacek, Mort Shelby, Jonathan Watkins, Tim Getman, James Lewis, Andy Clements, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, Tom Simpson, M.B. Van Dorn, Richard Rowan, Christopher Graybill, Colleen Delaney, Tim Carlin, Ken Jackson, Stephen Carpenter, Lily Beacon, Elizabeth Jernigan, Dylan Lynch, Scott McCormick, Terrence Aselford, Sherry Simpson, Karen Carbone, and Bobby Aselford. Book 5, Rules of Engagement, Part 1.
Halfway up the cliff, Brunn realized that someone was trying to kill her. She had already shifted weight from her left foot to her right foot when the thought penetrated. Instantly, her hands slicked with sweat, and she lost the grip of her weaker left hand on the little knob. She dipped it into her chalk and reached for the knob again, then chalked her right hand and refound that hold. That much was mechanical after these days in training. Someone was trying to kill you. You didn't have to help them by doing something stupid. She pushed up, releasing her right leg for the next move. Of course, in a general way, someone was trying to kill her or any other trainee. She had known that coming in. Better to lose trainees here than half-trained personnel in the field, where their failure would endanger others. Her breath eased as she talked herself into a sensible frame of mind. Right foot there, and then the arms moving, finding the next holds, and then the left leg. She fell, hit the end of her rope, and swung into the cliff face. A shot. Someone had shot at her. Hit her? Not enough pain. Must have been rock splinters. Reflexively, her hands and feet caught at the rock, sought grips, found them, took her weight off the climbing harness. Her head throbbed still. She shook it, and the halves of her climbing helmet slid down to hang from the straps like the wing cases of a crushed beetle.
Damn!
Reason be damned, someone was trying to kill her. Brunn glanced around quickly. Up, too far, too slow, too exposed. Down, 150 feet of falling in a predictable vertical line. To the right, nothing but open rock. To the left, a narrow vertical crack. They had been told not to use it this time, but she'd climbed in it before, learning about cracks and chimneys. If she could get there... She pushed off, and the next shot hit the cliff where her head had been, between head and right hand. Splinters of rock sprayed her hand, the right side of her face. She lunged for the next hold, not in a panic, but with the controlled speed of someone who knew just where each hold would be. Whoever it was had some reason not to fire on automatic at full speed. But now they knew which way she was going. She took a chance. For an instant, Brunn hung from her arms, feet scrabbling. Then she found the hold and the next. The sheltering crevice was just ahead. This time, it was her left hand that slipped when she reached too far.
Damn it!
The next shot shattered the hold for which he'd reached, loosing a shower of rock. She didn't hesitate. The breakage offered new holds. In a second, she was into the crevice, yanking hard on the rope for more, for enough to move into deeper cover. What she hoped the shooter didn't know was alignment of the crevice. The forces which had made it had produced an almost spiral fracture. Not 10 feet above, she could be safely hidden from the shooter. The rope from below dragged at her. No more slack. They hadn't understood. Or were they part of the plot? She yanked again unsuccessfully. Mitchell Langston Pardue, Ranger Bowie of the new Texas God-fearing militia on Our Texas, sat in his heavy carved chair and waited for the captain to finish reading his report. He stroked the carving on the right arm, supposed to resemble the old Texas animal called a dilla, whatever that had been, and thought how he could imply that the captain was an idiot without actually saying so.
Mitch, you paying attention?
Pete Robertson, Ranger Travis and Captain of Rangers, had an attitude that made Mitch want to slap him upside the head with something heavy. He was getting old, with a waddled neck like a turkey gobbler.
You bet, Captain. You see, we need about 30 more of them nukes from Familia's Regnant Space Fleet in order to top up the first depot. Your timetable for hitting the Grenessi is running behind a little.
It's stopped in its tracks like a Polack steer. And if we wait too long, they won't make the connection we want.
The Guernesi had reacted with vigor to the theft of a shipload of tourists and had gotten them back, though with casualties. Then they'd imposed a trade embargo and blown up a couple of ships to make a point that they held a grudge about the ones who had died.
We gotta get more weapons. And there's something wrong with our main agent in their space fleet headquarters. The last signal we got from him makes no sense.
Sam DuBois, Ranger Austin, sat forward.
He's getting old, though. He's had one of them prescribed procedures.
He was rejuvenated. They started rejuvenating their most senior NCOs about 10, 15 years ago, and he's one of them. If they hadn't, likely we wouldn't have gotten anything from him.
But it's an abomination.
Sam DuBois was stubborn as a mule and tighter than a tick to Parson Wells.
Yes, it's an abomination. I'm not saying it ain't. But the devil takes care of his own sometimes, and them rejuvenations have been working a while now. The man's only 80. His mind should be fine, even if he hadn't had the drugs.
Yeah, but it's not. Look at this here.
With a triumphant look at Mitch, the captain passed down a sheet of paper.
Gobbledygook. Did he change ciphers or something?
No. I think he's taken to some heathen practice, or that rejuvenation has eaten his brain. I've heard about that.
Everyone knew Robertson had read more widely in the dangerous literature of biomodification than was strictly approved by the Parsons. The captain was trying to trap him into a discussion that would prove his contamination, but Mitch was smarter than that. Instead, he had his own plan.
Captain, I'd like to make a proposal.
The captain's gaze didn't waver.
Sure.
You know, you gave me permission way last year to do some work in the Familias myself.
Yeah.
Well, sir, I cast bread on the waters, and let me tell you, there are hungry souls out there all athirst for the true word of God. I found some agents here and there in big trading firms and one in a regional weapons depot, an assistant station master. We've been getting a nice little flow of illicits in here for about 6 months.
Mitch pulled out his own report and passed it around.
More than that, gentlemen, anytime we want an entire cargo hold loaded with nukes or anything else, I've got just the person to do it. What I thought was, I'd go on and tell them to load up, and then go get us a transport as well as the weapons. There's this ship that takes a shortcut through a deserted system. Fine place for an ambush.
And you want our help, Ranger Bowie?
No, sir, I don't. With all respect, sir, there's too much going on to pull resources from the rest of our people. What I thought was, I'd take back all of the boys and take care of this little chore, and that should put us back on track for knocking the Grenessi flat on their tails.
What about the crew?
Our usual rules. We still need more females if we can find some that ain't too badly contaminated.
You know, we've had to mute damn near every foreign female we've brought in, and I worry about their effect on our women.
Yeah, we're real men. We can control our women.
Yeah, damn right.
I tell you what.
Besides, we know God approves because the imported women have strong, healthy babies. Hardly any of them born with defects.
A child's defects reflected parental sin. If healthy children came from women brought up in sin, then it must be because God celebrated their release from the abominations of the ungodly.
Parson Wells, bless your mission, Ranger Bowie. You have my approval.
When Pardue was captain of Rangers, which he fully intended to be, he'd never go belly up for anybody, like Robertson just did. When the parson came in, he explained the proposed mission again.
Just be sure to avoid contamination, Ranger Bowie.
Yes, sir, parson. I got no intention of going heathen.
He had every intention of coming back with weapons, women, wealth, and every intention of making it to the captaincy before he was many years older. Lieutenant Esme Suiza arrived at Training Command's Copper Mountain Base with high hopes, only to find herself waiting her turn for security clearance in a big reception hall with two of the ugliest murals she'd ever seen. On the right, over the comm booths, a scene of ships in combat in space. They looked nothing like ships as Esme had seen them from the outside. Realism would have been dull at best, but she couldn't help an internal smirk at the astronomical decorations. Stars, comets, spiral galaxies. On the left, over the luggage dumps, a scene depicting ground combat, which looked even less realistic than the space one. For one thing, nobody's uniform ever stayed that clean. For another, the artist had only a shaky grasp of anatomy and perspective. All the figures looked squashed sideways. Esme tried to get her mind back to her own high hopes. A change in track from technical to command, and she was finally pursuing her destiny, using her best talents. Certainly her commanders thought so. She had made friends, including Baron Serrano, who was, if she was honest with herself, much more than a friend. In his admiration, she felt herself more capable. In his concern, she felt herself loved. That still made her uncomfortable. She had never really thought about love, about being loved, and she could hardly believe it had happened, or that it might last. But she still felt the touch of his hands on her face. She pulled herself back from that memory and made herself consider what came next. She glanced at the space combat scene again and could not help shaking her head. The sergeant at the first security station smiled at her.
Gruesome, aren't they, sir? Supposed to be very old and valuable, but really, it looks like something done by a half-gifted amateur.
That's probably what they got.
Esme presented her orders and identification.
Lieutenant, new rules require a full med ID scan before you receive station tags. If you'll follow the yellow line to the next station, they'll get started.
Security had been tighter all the way across Familia space, a natural result of all that had happened in the past quarter year. Still, she hadn't expected the level of confirmation required here at a training base whose only access was through a fleet-controlled orbital station. Where were intruders supposed to be coming from? An hour later, she was waiting outside yet another security checkpoint. It was ridiculous.
How long does it take to do a retinal check? Even a full neuroscan?
Her stomach growled, reminding her that she'd broken one of the great rules of military life. Eat whenever you get a chance. She could have grabbed a snack before leaving the transport, but, her memory mocked her, it was only supposed to be a couple of hours down to Copper Mountain. In for the retinal check at last.
Just follow the yellow line, Lieutenant.
But can't you just...
Follow the yellow line.
Which ended in another bench to wait on until her name was called. Ahead of her was a whole squad of neuro-enhanced combat troops. She'd heard of these, but never seen any up close. They looked like anyone else who happened to be carrying about twice the muscle and half the fat of anyone else. They fell silent as she came up to the bench. Esme felt fragile beside them.
Excuse me, Lieutenant.
Esme looked up to see that they had reshuffled themselves to put one of the women next to her.
Yes? Are you the Lieutenant Suiza who was on Despite and then Kosciusko?
Esme nodded.
Lieutenant, I'm really glad to meet you. We've always wondered what it's like outside during FTL flight. Would you mind telling us about it? They tell us the debriefing sims won't be out for another 6 months.
It's really odd. First, the starfield disappears.
Suiza! If we don't take you now, you'll be here for hours. These neuro-enhanced jobs take forever.
Esme felt a wave of cold dislike rise from the seated squad and hoped they were aiming it at the clerk and not her.
Excuse me.
Of course, Lieutenant.
The woman who had asked her the question had green eyes, startling in her dark face. Then she looked beyond Esme to the clerk, and Esme was not surprised to feel the clerk stiffen. She hadn't had a full neuroscan since she entered the academy, and it was still as boring as ever, being stuck in the dark maw of the machine, following orders to think of this or that, or imagine moving her left little finger. Finally, it was done, and the last yellow line led her back to the desk where her duffel lay waiting for her, along with a handful of ID tags she would need for the facilities she was authorized to enter.
Junior officer's quarters and mess that way, sir.
The sergeant gave a crisp salute as he passed her through. Esme returned it and stepped onto the indicated walkway. She had missed out on command training once she'd chosen technical track, so now she would be taking back-to-back courses, more school. Her own fault, yet not a fault to spend much time on. Her Altiplano conscience worried about the quickness with which her retrained neurons pushed away that momentary pang of guilt, and she grinned mentally at it. Her Altiplano conscience, like her Altiplano family, could stay where it belonged, on Altiplano. She signed into the officer's quarters and the officer's mess, showing her clearance tags each time, picked up a duty roster, then a class schedule. She slung her gear into 235H, one anonymous cubicle in a row of anonymous cubicles, and then headed for the mess. Even if it was between mealtimes for the school, they should have something for officers arriving from different time zones. The dining room was almost empty when she walked in. A mess steward peered out from the galleys and then came toward her.
Lieutenant?
I just came in. Our ship was on...
Fleet standard. I understand, Lieutenant. You're overdue for midday, right? You want a full meal or a snack?
Just a snack.
She would get herself on the planet's schedule faster this way, but she felt hollow as a new-built hull at the moment. The steward seated her at a table a discreet distance from the two that were occupied and left to bring the food. Esme glanced casually at the others, wondering if they would be in her class. A young woman in fatigues, without insignia, her curly blonde hair cropped short, sat hunched over what looked like a bowl of soup. Beside her, an older man in a lieutenant commander's uniform who, from his posture, was laying down the law about something. Esme looked away. Unusual to chew someone out while they were eating, but it would be rude to observe.
Father and daughter?
At the other table, three young men wearing exercise clothes who were, she realized, watching her. She met their gaze coolly, and they looked away, not as if they were embarrassed, but as if they had seen all they wanted. Their gaze wandered the room steadily. They ignored the litter of plates and cups before them. The steward brought out a platter of sandwiches, pastries, and raw vegetable slices arranged in a fan-shaped pattern. Esme ate a sandwich of thinly sliced cantaloupe spread with horseradish sauce, several carrot sticks, and was considering one of the curly pastry things, which smelled so deliciously of cinnamon and hot apples.
I'm not quitting!
The young woman was sitting upright now, her face flushed slightly. With that flush, Esme could spot the irregular patches of fresh healing. She had been in a regen tank to repair some kind of injury to her face, and, Esme could not help looking, hands and arms. The older man threw a cautionary glance at Esme.
We can't effectively...
No, it's something else, something important.
This is completely unacceptable.
I know!
This was a bad act.
Then she too looked around and met Esme's eyes. Some instinct prompted Esme to look not merely down, but, under lowered lids, across at the other table. The three men there now made sense. Their dismissive assessment of her, their constant surveillance of the room. These were the bodyguards of someone who hired the best, or to whom the best were by custom assigned.
Who are they guarding?
Esme glanced back at the young woman, surprised by an expression on both faces so alike that it had to imply a relationship. Her eye, trained on a planet where families mattered, and where she had been expected to recognize even the most distant Suiza cousin, picked out now the similarities of bone and proportion, as well as behavioral quirks, like the sudden lift of eyebrow that both older man and younger woman showed at that moment.
Brun.
Esme's mind caught on the unusual word, Brun. Wasn't that... She clamped her mouth shut on the apple tart. If that was the blonde girl who had been involved in the Xavier affair, then her father was the present Speaker of the Grand Council, the most powerful man in the Familius Regnant. What could they be doing here? Speculation having outrun data, she munched steadily through the tart, studiously ignoring the argument which continued in lower voices at the other table. She struggled to remember all the snippets of rumor she'd heard about Thornbuckle's wild youngest daughter, a spoiled beauty, a hot-headed fool who had plunged into the thick of intrigue with no training, an idiot who'd ended up dead drunk and naked in a rockhopper's pod in the aftermath of a battle, but also something about being, in some obscure way, Admiral Vida Serrano's protege. because of her services to the Familius and, most particularly, to Admiral Serrano's niece, Harris.
Excuse me.
Esme swallowed the last bite of tart and looked up. It was one of the bodyguards.
Yes?
You're Lieutenant Suiza, aren't you?
Despite the therapy, her gut tightened.
Yes, that's right.
Lieutenant Commander Smith would like to meet you.
Lieutenant Commander Smith?
He nodded his head toward the other table.
Smith and his daughter.
For a moment, Esme wished that she had just lived with her hunger until the next scheduled main meal. She rose from the table.
Of course.
The older man and the young woman watched her approach with, Esme thought, the wrong sort of interest. The older man had the sort of face which might have been pleasant, but presently had locked into a tight mask of concern. The young woman looked both annoyed and afraid.
Commander Smith, I'm Lieutenant Suiza.
Have a seat.
Although his uniform fitted his tall, lanky body perfectly, she was sure it did not fit his spirit. It would have needed stars on the shoulders, and plenty of them.
This is an unexpected honor. I had heard about you, of course, from Admiral Serrano, after Xavier, and now this recent business.
This, for instance, was not the way a real lieutenant commander would have brought it up. Esme wondered whether to relieve him of the need for faking a military identity and opened her mouth to do so.
Dad, stop it.
Brune, I'm merely...
You're not really a lieutenant commander, and it's not fair.
The young woman turned to Esme.
I'm Brune Meager, Lord Thornbuckle's daughter, and this is my father.
I'm pleased to meet Commander Smith, under the circumstances.
Well, one of you young ladies has a bit of discretion.
I'm not being indiscreet. She could see you weren't really a fleet officer, and I could see the wheels going round in her head as she tried to figure out how to handle it.
One allows prominent people to introduce themselves as they choose. One's private curiosity never intrudes.
Where are you from?
Altiplano, where, on occasion, senior officials may choose to appear in borrowed identities.
And where good manners seem to have penetrated more than in some other places.
I don't like deception.
Oh, really? That's why you so carefully avoided using your own name when you were coming back to Rockhouse.
That was different. There was a good reason.
There's a good reason now, Brune. And if you can't see that, I'll go back to calling you Bubbles with reason.
For all his low, even voice and quiet face, Lord Thornbuckle was seriously angry. Esme wished she were on the other side of the planet. Father-daughter conflict raised ghosts she wanted laid to rest. Brune subsided, but Esme had the feeling she was not really subdued.
Perhaps we could continue this in another location.
Esme could think of no polite way to refuse, and she wasn't sure where her duty lay as an RSS officer. But she would have to report to class at 0800 local time the next morning, and she had a lot to do in the meantime. Still, he was who he was, and even who he wasn't outranked her.
Of course, sir.
Thornbuckle nodded to the men at the other table, who stood up.
I'm afraid we will have an escort.
That didn't bother Esme. What bothered her was landing in the middle of whatever mess this was. She noticed that the escort split up, two going ahead and one trailing behind. She couldn't tell whether or not they were fleet. She felt she should be able to tell. The civilians aboard Koss had been obvious enough. These didn't look like civilians, but they didn't quite fit fleet, either. The conference room they finally entered was small, centered with a table large enough for only eight or so to surround. It had a display console at one end, but Lord Thornbuckle ignored that. He waited until his escort nodded, then sat at one end of the table. Habit, Esme supposed.
Sit down, and I'll make this as brief as possible. You haven't been here long, have you?
Just got off the shuttle, sir. I'm here for the command courses I missed earlier, and then the standard junior officer's course.
The one that would qualify her to command a ship in combat, according to the Board of Inquiry, which had recommended it. Of course, not being qualified hadn't stopped her yet, but she put that out of her mind and prepared to focus on whatever Lord Thornbuckle had to say.
My daughter wanted to take some training with fleet experts. I agreed, in part because she'd gotten herself into so much trouble without training. It seemed the risk-taking genes had all come together in her.
And the lucky genes. I know they're not enough, but they're also not negligible. That's what Captain Commander Serrano said, and her Aunt Admiral.
The thought of anyone calling Vida Serrano Aunt Admiral, even a niece, shocked Esme. For this girl, for Brunn was clearly younger than she was, to do so would have been unthinkable except that Brunn had just done it.
But there have been incidents. I thought she'd be safer here, on a fleet training facility.
I am safer.
Brunn, face the facts. Someone shot at you, tried to kill you.
Esme managed not to say what she was thinking, that a fleet training facility was not, in the nature of things, the safest place in the universe. Live fire exercises, for instance.
It wasn't anywhere near a live fire exercise. That was my first thought, of course. Military training is dangerous, it has to be. But we, and by we I mean not only myself, but others who've seen Brunn in action, thought it would be less dangerous than turning her loose on the universe untrained. No, this has been different. I suppose we were just careless. We knew there were traitors in Fleet. That mess with Xavier proved it. But it didn't dawn on me that there might be traitors here, in a training base, until Admiral Serrano pointed it out. We knew that Brunn might be at special risk, but we didn't react fast enough.
I'm alive.
You survived with your usual flair. But you also had to spend a day in the regen tank, which is not what I call coming out unscathed. Too close for comfort, is my analysis. You have to have more protection, or you have to leave.
Brunn's shoulders twitched.
I'll be careful.
Not good enough. You have to sleep sometime.
Have you identified the nature of the threat?
No, not precisely. And the worst of it is that I can see a variety of threats. The Benignity's not happy with their loss at Xavier, and we are sure they have other agents in Fleet. Some have been identified, others haven't. They consider assassination a political tool. The Blood Horde, well, you can imagine how they would like to have my daughter in their control. Then there are my personal enemies among the Familiars. A few years ago, I would not have believed any of the families would make war on personal relations. But now, things have changed.
And you or your advisors think your daughter should leave this facility?
It would be easier to protect her at home, or even on Castle Rock.
I would go crazy. I'm not a child, and I can't just sit around doing nothing.
Do you want to join Fleet?
Esme couldn't really imagine this obvious rebel wanting to join anything with discipline, but if she hadn't understood... Brunn eyed her father.
I did at one time. Now, I'm not sure.
She doesn't want to get stuck doing boring things.
It's not that.
Isn't it? When Captain Serrano pointed out how much of her time was spent on boring routine, you said you didn't much like that prospect.
I don't. But that's part of any life. I do understand that. Just as I understand that the exciting bits are dangerous. You seem to think...
Perhaps you should tell me what you think I might do to help.
She needs a mentor. If she's going to stay here, I need to know that someone of her...
Esme could almost hear the unspoken, discarded choices. Social standing, rank, type, ability.
Someone she might respect and listen to anyway will be near her. She's been chattering about you and your exploits.
I do not chatter.
So I thought maybe you...
She has her own responsibilities, and there are the guards.
Are you telling me now that you will accept the security procedures we talked about?
Brunn gave Esme a challenging look.
Rather than bother Lieutenant Sweezer? Yes. She will be busy with her own courses here, and they don't exactly give officers time off to play nursemaid to rich girls.
Thornbuckle looked from one to the other of them.
I have seen more cooperative senior ministers of state. Whatever gene sculpting we did on you, Brunn, it's not going to be repeated.
I didn't ask for it.
No, but life gives you a lot you didn't ask for. Now, if you promise me that you will cooperate with the new security procedures...
All right, I'll cooperate.
Then, Lieutenant Sweezer, I'm very sorry to have wasted your time, and I must thank you for your recent actions. You well deserve your award.
Lord Thornbuckle nodded at the new ribbon on her uniform.
Thank you.
Esme wondered if she was just supposed to leave and forget the conversation had ever happened. She turned to Brunn and suppressed an almost wistful expression on her face.
If we end up in the same class, I'll be glad to share notes with you. I'm glad to have met you.
Esme got up when Thornbuckle did, and he walked her to the door.
I'm officially still Smith.
I understand, sir.
Esme understood more than she wanted to, or than he expected. She was glad to get back to her own quarters, where she could deal with her memories of her father in privacy. There, she found a stack of study cubes in the delivery bin and racked them into the cube reader's storage. Some looked much more promising than others. Leadership for junior officers made sense, but why did she have to study administrative procedures for junior staff? She didn't want anything to do with administration. Brunn curled up on her bunk under her very non-regulation afghan and pretended to nap until her security detail had finished whatever it was doing and gone to stand outside, as if she were a prisoner, as if she were a naughty child, as if being shot at were her fault. Her father had done it again. She would have been fine if he had only been somewhere else, if only she had had time to get well before he showed up. But no, he had to come here, still unsure she should be doing things like this, and embarrass her in front of a room full of professionals.
In front of Esme Sweezer.
She rolled over and picked up her remote, then flicked on her cube reader, cycling through the selections until she found the one she wanted. Back on Xavier, while she herself was drunk and incapable, as her father had mentioned more than once, Esme Sweeza had survived the treachery of her captain, the mutiny that followed, and then saved everyone, including Brunn, by blowing up the enemy flagship. Brunn had followed the court-martial of Despite's crew in the news. She had wondered over and over how that calm young woman with the flyaway hair managed to do it. She didn't look that special, but something in the expression, in the eyes that never wavered, caught at her. And then the same young woman had been a hero again in an adventure that seemed like something out of a Story Cube series. She had been outside a ship during FTL flight and survived. She had defeated another enemy. Once more, her image filled the news viewers. And once more, Brunn had imagined meeting her, talking to her, becoming, she was sure they could become, friends. When she'd learned that Esme Sweeza was coming here to Copper Mountain, that she might even be in the same classes, she had been so certain that her luck was running true. Here at last was the woman who could help her be like that, help her combine her uncooperative past experiences into the self she wanted to be. And now her father had ruined it. He had treated Sweeza as a professional worthy of respect. He had made it clear he thought Brunn was a headstrong child. What would Esme Sweeza think now? What could she think when the Speaker of the Grand Council, her own father, had presented her that way? It was impossible that Sweeza could see her as a competent adult. She would not let it be impossible. She would not let this chance go by. There had to be some way to convince Sweeza that she was more than a silly fluffhead. Fluffhead made her think of Sweeza's hair, which could certainly use some attention. Maybe Sweeza would be approachable on a girl-to-girl level first, and then she could prove what else she could do. At the next main meal, a few hours later, Esme returned to the mess and sat with a table full of jigs and lieutenants who had arrived the day before. She remembered a few of them from the academy, but had not served with any of them. They knew of her recent exploits and were eager to discuss them.
What's it like to fly a Bloodhorde Raider?
In the 6 years since their graduation, Vericor, another lieutenant, had gained several kilos and now sported a crisp red mustache. Esme knew the expected response.
Fun. Goes like a bat, even if you don't redline it.
Shielding?
None to speak of. And the weapon systems are amazing for its size. The interior's mostly weapons, very little crew space.
They must have lousy shooting if they missed you.
They didn't shoot at us first. After all, I was in their ship. They let us get close and poof.
Yeah, that's the way. What are you here for?
A whole string of things. I'm changing to command track.
You mean you weren't?
No.
That's fleet personnel for you. Take someone with a flair like yours and shove her into technical just because they need more techs. They ought to recruit techs if they want more.
Esme opened her mouth to explain it hadn't been Fleet's fault, considered the difficulty of the subsequent explanations, and nodded instead.
Yep. So now they've let me into command track, and I have to play catch-up. All the stuff I missed.
They're not going to drag you through command psychology and all that, Dorf.
Esme nodded.
When you've actually commanded ships in battle, that's ridiculous.
No, that's regulations.
Esme was enjoying herself, she realized, with people who were almost strangers, even without Baron. The discovery that she could enjoy herself like this was new enough that it still surprised her when it happened.
You know, I heard the Speaker's daughter's here.
Well, she's run through the whole of Royal Space Service. I suppose she's looking for new blood.
Esme pursed her lips. She could not say anything without revealing knowledge she wasn't supposed to have.
Is it true she was floating around in a rockhopper's pod, stark naked at Xavier?
Alone?
That's the story. My cousin, you know Liam Esme, he was on Despite. He said he heard from a buddy on the flagship that she got stewed and somehow ended up out there all alone. But Liam's a bit inventive. I figured Esme would know if it really happened.
Why?
Because they'd have put a young female officer with her afterwards. I figured that would be you.
Not me. I was busy doing scut work on Despite. Never even saw her.
Until now, but that was another thing she couldn't tell them. When she left the table, she glanced around but did not see Brunn.
Does the girl have meals alone somewhere?
Esme pushed aside the thought that the girl might be lonesome. Brunn Meager was not her problem. This course was. At 0500 local time the next morning, Esme shivered in the chill pre-dawn breeze, much cooler than ship standard. The air smelled of growing things and distance, sharply different from ship air. It wasn't home, but some of the smells were the same. Her shivering didn't last long once the exercise started. Esme grinned to herself. She had always worked out faithfully, but some of these people clearly had not. She was sweaty but not exhausted after an hour and a half. She had surprised herself by coming in fourth in the final run around the drill field. In the distance, she had seen the irregular cliffs for which Copper Mountain was named emerge from pre-dawn dimness to show the oranges and reds and ochres when the sun hit them. The whole time, Varricor complained loudly but good-naturedly. She suspected it was mostly for effect. He didn't seem to be breathing any harder than she was, and it took breath to complain. He neared her as they jogged toward their quarters.
When's your first class?
Not class. Testing. They think I can test out of some things to make room for others.
Esme hoped so. Otherwise, her schedule would be impossible. They parted with a wave, and Esme went in to shower, thinking how different he was from Baron. He was older. He was her peer. He was pleasant and handsome, and about as exciting as a bowl of porridge. That first day passed in a blur of activity. She tested out of some sections. She'd been told she probably would. Scan, as she expected, and Holland architecture, which she had not. She must have picked up more of that on Kosciusko than she'd thought. The military law segment concentrated on treason, mutiny, and conduct unbecoming, giving her an unfair advantage, she thought, but she wasn't going to complain. Administrative procedures, though, was her downfall, along with tables of organization and command chains in areas where she'd never served. The testing officer frowned over her test results.
Well, your schedule's going to be all over the place. If you actually took both courses back to back, you'd be here 5 standard months. You placed out of about half the lower course and a tenth of the upper. Well, let's see now.
He finally produced a schedule that looked impossible for the first 2 weeks, though he claimed that two of the classes were no-brainers and merely difficult for the next 7. She had a few choices and picked Search and Rescue Basic and Escape and Evasion. They sounded more active than the optional staff support and administrative methods courses. Besides, she knew they were practical. She didn't want to end up in Baron's situation. By the end of the first 5 days, Esme felt settled in the academic routine. She was carrying about half again as many hours as her classmates, but the pace of instruction was much slower than it had been at the academy. Early morning PT woke her up for the day's classes, and she didn't have to stay up too late to get all the work completed. Already, some of the others had established a habit of going into Q-Town when classes let out, eating there instead of in the mess hall. She was almost glad that her extra classes made that impossible for her. She had never socialized off-ship with other officers and felt shy about it now. Many did not go into town every evening, and whenever she emerged from her room for a break, she would find someone ready to chat or play a quick game in one of the rec rooms. Administrative procedures was as dull as she'd feared, though she understood the importance of the course. She tackled it as she had tackled technical data in scan or hull architecture, and found she could remember all the niggling little details even if she was bored by them. Professional ethics for military officers was another matter. She had started in eagerly, expecting, she wasn't quite sure what, but not what she got. Three lectures on personal relationships left her feeling unsure and guilty about her friendship with Baron Serrano. Example after example where a senior officer's pursuit had damaged, if not ruined, a junior's career. Examples of apparently innocent liaisons which ended in grief for all concerned. She wondered if he was talking about one of her academy classmates, a stunning blonde from the Crescent Worlds. She hadn't seen Cassie since graduation, but she had heard that she had moved on from classmates to more senior officers. And yet, the instructor had insisted, Fleet had neither the desire nor the power to prohibit close friendships and even marriage between officers. The standards governing such relationships were, according to the instructor, perfectly clear and reasonable. Esme could recite them forwards and backwards without knowing for sure if she and Baron had done anything wrong or if going where they had talked about going was forbidden. She wished she had someone to ask about it. To her relief, her tactical analysis class did not consider either the action at Xavier or the Kosciusko defense. Along with her classmates, she plunged instead into a comparison of Familius and Benignity, small ship capabilities, and battle performance. Veracour was her assigned partner.
Lies. Damn lies and statistics. I hate statistical analyses of battles. It's more than just so many tons throw weight.
Esme extracted another set of figures from the archives.
Did you know that Benignity had better battle performance out of Pierrot than we did after they captured her?
No, that's gotta be wrong. None of their tacticians use maneuver the way we do.
Yup. Renamed Volutis, confirmed from salvage. Their commander got 5 hits on Tarngeld at extreme range.
Says who?
Veracour leaned over to look.
You trust that scan data from Tarngeld?
Well, it's embarrassing to have to admit you were clobbered by a ship a third your mass, which used to be on your side. So I bet on its being accurate. Besides, according to the post-battle plot, nothing else was in that direction. My question is, what did they do to Pyrrho Volutis to make her that effective? And are they doing that to their other ships?
Wouldn't think so. They didn't at Xavier, did they?
Not that I know of, but they had Pyrrho for 3 years before she showed up in their lines.
Well, someone must have noticed that.
Yes, but did they apply it? If the Benignity does whatever it did to that ship to others of the same size, we've got a whole new element to worry about.
Maybe, but if they could, they'd have used it at Xavier, wouldn't they?
Oh, I wish I knew what it was. It matters if it was some one-time thing that depended on some of our architecture.
One really good scan tech? Weapons tech?
Maybe, but if they've got one that good, they might have more. I think we ought to make this one of the main points of our presentation.
I'm not going to argue with the hero of Xavier and the Koss. It's not something I would have thought of. Maybe you are that smart.
I'd do my best.
He wasn't Baron, but he was comfortable. Esme was still thinking that when Veracour reached out and touched her hair. Esme managed not to flinch, but she moved smoothly away.
Sorry, I just thought you might like it.
So Baron wasn't the only man who could find her attractive. She didn't know whether she found that reassuring or just bothersome. At least she knew for sure that another lieutenant was within the limits allowed by regulations and the ethics class.
I'm not in the mood.
She couldn't explain about Baron, or claim a pre-existing relationship. Not yet.
If you ever are in the mood, just let me know. I'll even swear on whatever you like that it's not just hero worship.
I didn't think it was.
Varricor grinned back, but made no more advances. That's what the manuals all said was supposed to happen, but she'd never had to deal with it before. She felt a small burst of surprise that the manuals were right. A few days later, their presentation gained the highest rating in the class. Afterwards, Varricor suggested a celebratory drink in Q-Town, the little cluster of commercial establishments just outside the gates.
You're certainly good luck. I hope we're on the same team for E&E. They say no one ever makes it all the way through field exercise without getting captured. But you might be able to pull it off.
I doubt it. The instructors know the terrain backwards and forwards, just like natives.
Well, it would be more fun with you anyway. So, will you come?
No. Remember, I'm taking extra classes, and I have a final in admin procedures tomorrow.
Varricor bowed elaborately.
My sympathies.
So he was no Baron. He was still fun to be around. She went back to her quarters and tore into the admin procedures material until long past her usual bedtime. The next morning, Esme was surprised to see Brunn Meager lining up for PT with the others. During the run, she moved up beside Esme.
Hi. Oh, I hardly ever see you.
I've got a heavy schedule.
Unlike many, Esme actually enjoyed the run. But one of the things she enjoyed about it was sinking into a meditative state.
So I noticed. This was the only thing I could take right now where we overlap. But I'm going to be in your escape and evasion course.
You?
Esme glanced at her. Brunn loped along as if she could run forever.
Mm-hmm. Well, if people are out to get me, I need to learn how to get away.
I suppose.
And I wanted to ask you, if we get a choice, I'd like to be on your team.
Great. Just what I need, a spoiled rich girl on my team.
Esme glanced at Brunn again. Brunn might be spoiled, but she was willing to work and learn. Not every rich girl would pile out of bed at that hour to do PT with a lot of grumpy soldiers. Admiral Serrano had sponsored her. That had to be worth something. Rumor had it, she didn't ask any favors in her classes either.
I don't know if we get a choice, but if it's possible, it's all right with me.
And if you ever wanted, we could go into Q-Town together.
No time.
You don't ever go?
No. They have good steaks in the mess.
And good steaks constitute your definition of entertainment.
No, but I wouldn't expect you to find much entertainment there either.
Well, I like a drink with friends now and then. Or a meal outside, just because it is outside. That red-headed Lieutenant Varricor? Is he a friend of yours?
We were classmates, and we've been assigned some problems together.
But you like him?
He's nice. He goes to Q-Town fairly often.
I know. I've seen him there with friends. I wondered why you didn't go.
Schedule. I've got a final this morning.
What in?
Administrative procedures.
Oh, sounds dull. I guess I should let you review it in your head.
That would have been nice, but they were almost back to the starting point. Esme was glad she'd spent the extra hours the night before. Varricor came up alongside Esme as they headed toward the first of the escape and evasion classes.
There's going to be an ensign in our class.
Esme hoped her face didn't reveal anything. Baron had left a message saying he was down, but she hadn't seen him yet. She had back-to-back classes.
An ensign? So?
Well, this is a bit upper level for an ensign, don't you think? But I hear he's a Serrano. That probably explains it. Says he was on Kosciuszko.
Esme finally realized Varricor was fishing, and what he was fishing for. She wanted to strangle him. She stopped at the next data port to suck the class list.
Let me see. Oh, yes. Baron Serrano. I know him.
She hoped that was sufficiently casual. Her eye ran on down the list and got snagged on Brunhilde Meager. She had hoped someone would talk the girl out of this. The class was known to be dangerous, but there she was.
And?
Esme gave Varricor a glance that moved him back a half step. Good.
He's a fine junior officer. What more do you want?
Was he on your crew on the Bloodhorde ship?
No.
And she was not going to tell Baron's secrets either. Varricor could find out for himself. In the classroom, she saw Brunn first. The tall blonde was leaning on a desk, surrounded by male officers, while her bodyguards stood by the wall, looking as blank as robots. She had, Esme had to admit, an infectious laugh and a smile that lit up the room. Esme moved to a seat midway up on the left side and then spotted Baron, front row right, already seated and looking compact and composed.
Should I go up there?
But Esme was already in her seat, and Varricor was in the next. It would be obvious if she moved. Baron turned, as if her glance were a warm hand on his neck, and spotted her. He smiled, nodded. She nodded in return. Enough for now. They could talk later. Although, certain paragraphs in the professional ethics lectures came back to her. They would have to be careful. They were not presently in the same chain of command, but she was senior enough that the relationship would be called not recommended. At the chime, the instructor came in. He looked as if he'd been slow-dried over a fire, the color of jerky and not any more extra fat. Lieutenant Commander Euless, his name was.
Escape and evasion. If you're lucky, you'll never need this course. But if you need it and haven't mastered it, you'll be dead. Or worse.
He glanced around the room, then his gaze rested on Baron.
I understand that Ensign Serrano already has experience as a captive, but none at all in escape.
Baron said nothing. The others had turned to look at him.
It is the duty of a captured officer to attempt to escape, is it not, Serrano?
Yes, sir.
Yet you did not.
I did not escape, sir.
Did you even try?
Esme could feel the tension in the room.
Not effectively, sir.
I would have thought a Serrano the equal of a few Bloodhorde thugs. Would you care to explain to the class your mistakes?
Sir, I was careless. I thought the person I saw in the inventory bay wearing a fleet uniform with fleet patches was fleet personnel.
Ah. You expected the Bloodhorde to be fur-clad barbarians carrying swords?
No, sir. But I didn't expect them to be laying an ambush in the inventory bay. As I said, sir, my carelessness.
And precisely how did they capture you, Ensign?
I was climbing an inventory rack. The Deep Space Repair has automated inventory racks, some 20 meters tall, but the machinery had been shut off. Ship regulations required using safety harness and line, so I was clipped into the ladder I was climbing. The parts trays were far enough apart that someone could lie flat in them. When I climbed up that far, I found a gun to my head.
And did you struggle?
Yes, sir. But between the harness and the ones who grabbed my legs and getting knocked unconscious, not effectively.
I see. The lesson here is that a moment's inattention, a brief lapse of caution, can and someday will result in your capture. The ensign thought that he was safe aboard a fleet vessel, even though he knew intruders had penetrated the ordinary defenses. He saw nothing, heard nothing, smelled nothing, felt nothing, and no doubt convinced himself that anything out of the ordinary was the result of the overall emergency situation. Someone else would take care of it. He is lucky to be alive, presumably only because his captors thought he might be useful that way. But the ensign did do something right. Two things, in fact. He stayed alive when it might have been easier to die, and he worked through his post-capture trauma properly, as demonstrated by his reactions just now.
Sir, I don't understand.
Lieutenant Marden, I presume.
Yes, sir.
Kindly identify yourself next time, and haste in this course can get you killed. When you don't understand, wait. Be still. Listen. You might learn something that will save your life.
Everyone was very still. Esme found it hard to breathe. Even Brunn had gone immobile, she noticed.
But since I was going to explain anyway, I will now. Ensign Serrano could no doubt have changed his captor's decision to keep him alive by being too much trouble, while not able to escape. From my understanding, having reviewed his debrief, he had no real opportunity to escape. Therefore, his duty was to stay alive, if possible, by not driving his captors to kill him. This he did, enduring physical abuse without losing control. making no threats, being as passive as possible. Second, he cooperated fully with remedial therapy. Some rescued captives cannot face what they consider the shame of such therapy, although they cannot evade a minimum requirement. They do not cooperate and do not receive the benefit of it. Ensign Serrano, by all reports, and of course most of this is confidential, so I have only the output summary, cooperated completely, and his therapists were convinced that he had no residual psychological complications. Some of you, no doubt, thought I was being rough on Ensign Serrano. Sarcastic? Critical. I was. I was testing for myself the validity of the therapist's report before putting him through the trauma of this course, where any unresolved issues might make him a danger to himself and others. He passed my test. The rest of you, we'll just have to see about.
Eulis turned to Baron. The back of Baron's neck was no longer flushed.
Ensign Serrano?
Sir.
Congratulations.
Sir.
I presume you've all read the introductory material for this class?
Eulis's gaze scanned the classroom. Esme had, as usual, read beyond the introductory assignment, but she judged from the uneasy shifting of some classmates that they had not. Eulis glanced down at his display.
Lieutenant Terrace, please explain the legal difference between military capture and hostile seizure.
Terrace had been one of the Wigglers, seated two down from Esme. She rose to her feet.
Sir, military capture is when a unit surrenders, and hostile seizure is when they're caught off guard.
And the legal situation?
Well, one is surrender, and one is being caught.
Inadequate. I assume you did not read the assignment, is that correct?
Terrace looked deservedly wretched.
Yes, sir.
Eulis looked along the row.
Lieutenant Vericor.
Vericor stood.
Sir, I read it, but I'm not sure I understand. I mean, it's clear when someone is kidnapped from a space station while they're on leave or something, as compared with the surrender of personnel from a damaged ship.
Suppose you were sure that you were facing a situation of hostile seizure. What would be your legal position?
Sir, the code says that I am to attempt escape by any means possible, assisting others to escape.
Yes, and what obligation do your captors have toward you?
If they're signatories to the Atopki Conference, which the Benignity of the Compassionate Hand and the Guarni Republic are, but the Blood Horde are not, they are obliged to provide adequate life support and medical care.
Well enough. Lieutenant Suiza.
Vericor sat down and Esme rose.
Please define Ensign Serrano's situation in terms of the legal issue I've raised.
Sir, although Ensign Serrano was captured on board a fleet vessel, his situation is more like a hostile seizure than military surrender. Since the Blood Horde are not signatories to the Atopki Conference, they acknowledge no obligation to captives under any circumstances, but Familius law still holds them responsible.
Very well.
Eulis nodded, and Esme sat down. In a few minutes, he had determined exactly who had read the assignment and who had not, and who was inclined to be hasty or foolish. Brunn was one of the latter, not to Esme's surprise. Eulis had just called on her and found that she had not read the assignment either and had told her it was even more important for her than for the others.
I don't see why.
Eulis looked at her, a long, considering look.
Even a civilian, Sarah Meager, is expected to abide by the basic courtesies of the class. Please request permission to speak and identify yourself before blurting out your ignorance. Better still, listen a little longer and see if you can learn on your own.
Brun's neck reddened, and Esme could see the tension in her shoulders. But she said nothing more, and Eulis turned to someone else. Esme could not relax, no matter whose behavior was under his harrow. She almost regretted choosing this class, except that Baron was in it.